Okay, I wanted to start with sort of just providing the setting here. Some of my favorite quotes. So some of you have heard of these things. You know, biologists start to read this and say, all models are wrong. This is great. We could ignore the models, but some are useful. Box was actually, there's a famous, rather famous evolutionary geneticist named Sir Ronald Fisher, who also founded a good chunk of the theory of statistics. Box, I believe, was Fisher's son-in-law, a statistician. And then Bohr's had come along independently and said, also, you ought to worry about this, that no theory should, you know, if you're a biologist and the theory doesn't seem to fit, you need to worry about the possibility that it's actually the facts that are wrong, not the theory that are wrong. I like this statement by Feynman, what I cannot build, I cannot understand. And this is why we use population genetics theory to understand the process of evolution, just for the same reasons people in biophysics use mathematical formulations to understand biophysical processes. We have a real problem in evolutionary biology with arm waving, way, way too much arm waving. And I'll make some fairly strong statements about this because I really want to make sure in evolutionary cell biology we don't go down the wrong path and just start doing this kind of thing. This is one of my favorite quotes. In other words, and this applies, I think, very nicely to here, you can't just make stuff up. We have a choice to make, and that choice is clear, and that would be population genetics. So population genetics isn't our answer to everything, but it does help provide a formal quantitative framework for what is and what isn't possible. That's really the main point here. And I do want to emphasize population genetics has a very, very long history, going back to the seminal paper was a paper by Ronald Fisher in 1918 in an obscure journal now extinct called the Proceedings of the Royal Society of Edinburgh. In that paper, he demonstrated that continuous variation in any kind of morphological trait can be understood in terms of basic Mendelian segregation at single genetic loci. So he really extended the simplest population genetic concepts to really multi-locus traits. The same paper, he invented the analysis of variants. So this is a foundational paper also for statistics. And the term dominance that many of you heard of, that was, and epistasis was first defined in this paper. So this is, to me, one of the greatest papers of all time. Theory of regression goes back to Ronald Pearson. So a lot of statistical methods that you all use actually have roots in population genetics. So initially a little bit of a diatribe. Before I get into the math, I just want to make some general points, and I guess I've already made this, that the principles of population genetics are so well established, and in my opinion at least, the credibility of any proposed scenario in evolution ought to be in doubt until it can be shown to be consistent with basic population genetic principles. I'm going to be covering only a tiny section at the most elementary state of population genetics, and I don't want to leave you in the impression that everything you've heard here in the next 2.5 hours is the whole field. I'm just trying to give you a flavor of what we can do, and we have a very, very mixed audience, and this talk is primarily for the people who have no background in population genetics whatsoever. So those of you in that from that kind of background, make sure you ask me if I gloss over even, you know, some basic definitions that have been in my head for an awful long time and I might not appreciate or are not in your head. So I've already pointed this out, that one of the critical issues to worry about in evolutionary theory is that we all believe in natural selection. It's a very powerful force, but what selection can and can't do, as I mentioned on Monday, is dictated by the population genetic environment. And by that I mean the forces that influence the transmission of genes from generation to generation. They have nothing to do with selection. And I'll talk about this more, tomorrow afternoon, mutation. This varies by an order, almost 4 orders of magnitude among organisms. So the rate of input of variation depends on what phylogenetic lineage you live in. I'll talk about recombination a bit today, and we'll see this varies. The amount of recombination per physical distance varies by about 4 orders of magnitude among organisms. That has a huge influence on multi-locus evolution, traits that depend on more than one mutation at one site. And then the power of random genetic drift is what I'll start talking about, and that varies by about perhaps as much as 6 orders of magnitude, the noise in the evolutionary process. So all of these things, the variation among phylogenetic lineages is not trivial. And then you can imagine ratios of these things sometimes varying by even more orders of magnitude. So we have to worry about these things. I think you're all aware of this, is that most biologists and general scientists believe that essentially every feature of the organism is molded by natural selection and nothing else. So if you grew up and the only experience you've had in the field of evolution was reading Richard Dawkins, then that's what you would think. On the other hand, if you grew up reading Stephen Jay Gould, who is one of Dawkins' great enemies, Gould felt that random genetic drift was an extremely powerful force explaining a lot of biodiversity. These guys didn't talk to each other very much. And to be honest, neither one really has a background in population genetics. There's a lot of arm waving that goes on in this. They're great writers, of course. And I think they've turned a lot of people on to evolutionary biology that wouldn't have ever been turned down. But you know, we have these giant shelves. If there's any field of science, you go to an average bookstore and find a giant shelf of books, popular science books, it's evolutionary biology. And I want to make this point here that for cell biology, it's unclear whether natural selection is either a necessary or a sufficient condition for the origin of the complexities that we see in cells, the metabolic complexity in bacteria and the morphological complexity in eukaryotes. And I wanted to make one point and then I'll get into the theory, but this connects with actually a question that Joel raised the other day when I sort of alluded to this issue of, can we explain complex structures in cells by invoking selection? So this is just a crude depiction of the kind of problem. I'm not saying we have the answers at all, but I want you to just think about how effectively neutral processes could lead to complex structures. So this is just an allusion to the ribosome. The heart of the ribosome, of course, is a couple of important RNA molecules. And then it's surrounded by this cocktail of proteins. So the bacterial ribosome, the small subunits associated with 21, and the large 33 proteins. So about 54 proteins are involved. The mitochondrion, which came from an ancient bacterium, it's got an expansion of the number of proteins associated with it. Is that necessary to have a ribosome? And you know, it clearly worked with fewer proteins over here. Do we need to do that expansion? Was that advanced by selection or not? And then we get into the cytoplasmic ribosome, and I guess we've got, 47 plus 32, almost 80 proteins. So there's been expansion. And this is just based on a small sampling. We don't really know the structure of the ribosome in many lineages across the tree of life. But the point is there's variation in this, and it looks like there's been an expansion in eukaryotes. So we briefly touched upon this issue of what might be called neutral constructive evolution. This is just a way to start thinking about how complexity might arise in a way that's not driven by the basic adaptive nature of complexity. So imagine you have some protein A that carries out some function, green arrow function here. And then some other protein in the cell just sort of adventitiously decides it likes to glue itself onto A. Nothing, let's just say nothing gained, nothing lost here. Strictly not true, of course. There's energy to produce B, and B might have had some other function. But this happens. And what this does is it, in principle, what it might do is it might change the structural environment. So there's what you might call pre-suppressing mutations here. So normally proteins like to be well wrapped and have the hydrophilic amino acids on the outside. But now you've covered up a patch on A. Now, initially, when this starts to happen, you could lose B, and A will be, there have been no other changes to A, and A was functional before, and it'd be functional again. But now, imagine what might happen. This is suppressing, potentially, the phenotypic effects of mutations in A that might reside along that interface. So that's a red mutation. That would normally be a deleterious mutation with respect to the function of A, but its effects are hidden, they're suppressed by B. At this point, if you eliminated B, A would be non-functional, or at least partially non-functional. And then over time, you might imagine this interface growing. These might just be simply hydrophobic residues or something that are hidden from water molecules over time. B might even eventually pick up some kind of other function. But this interface gets strengthened and strengthened to the point that now A can no longer live without B. And there's been no direct selective advantage. This complex molecule out here might be carrying out the same function as this at the same catalytic rate and so on. But we've grown this sort of more complex structure. Lots of questions arise here. Well, there's one back there in the corner. Andrew. Exactly. There's one question, right? So what is the relative incidence of the mutations that cause this kind of change as opposed to others? So that's one issue. And this is the point I'm trying to make. You use the word math. I mean, this is sort of an arm waving thing here. And this is what's absent from this general argument about neutral constructive evolution. There's other issues. I don't want to spend too much time on this, but you know, does it matter if A and B, they're encoded by different loci, the famous A and B loci. Does it matter if there's free recombination between them or not? Because then that can separate the joint effects of mutations in different individuals and so on.
Can I just clarify something? So whenever you make arguments like this, is it implicit that there must be some form of bottleneck involved? Because if there's no advantage in terms of alleles moving in the population in terms of fixing or otherwise,
let's hold on to that one because this is where I'm heading. I just wanted to provide this as sort of, before I get into the math, I just wanted to provide this as sort of a setting that you may not think this is a plausible argument for evolution of complexity by non-adaptive processes, but I think we have to entertain the possibility that everything's not driven by selection. So I'll get in, I'll be addressing the point you made and several others. So this is where we're heading. I hope we can get through all this. First of all, I want to demystify the process of random genetic drift. There's a lot of people who sort of view this as some kind of mystical process. Every population is subject to the processes of random genetic drift. It's stochasticity in the evolutionary process. Although Will Provine, who some of you may know, recently wrote a book. He's a great historian of science, has written great historical account of Sewell Wright's life and the origin of population genetics, but he recently came out with a book that he published himself demonstrating the impossibility of random genetic drift. The cover of the book, when he sent it to me, said, "Mike, I think you will be deeply disturbed by this book." I wasn't disturbed, I was a bit entertained. But okay, the second point we'll start with a very simple model of random genetic drift and then make it a little more complex. And we need to come up with a definition of population size. It's easy to count the number of heads in a population, but that's not the population size that we worry about usually in population genetics. We worry about a thing called the effective size. From there, then, we'll make models of increasing complexity. So we will initially start out with just drift as being the only evolutionary process. Then we'll add in mutations. So we have mutations arising now, allowing for long-term evolutionary change, but initially we'll assume they're neutral, and this will lead to what some of you may have heard of, the neutral theory of molecular evolution. And it's not too hard to derive some of the simplest results there. And then we'll get into selection. The very simplest selection models, single sites at a time, which aren't necessarily realistic when we start thinking about complex cellular features. And then we'll move on to what happens when you have two mutations that are critical to an adaptation and they interact in non-additive ways that we refer to as epistasis. So first of all, random genetic drift. So let's start out with a very simple way of looking at the world. Everything's neutral here. We start with a population. It's a very small population. There's about 10 round balls up there. and there happened to be three flavors here, three different alleles in the population. And then we start with this generation here, and then we're going to make another generation. So we have each one of these individuals here has a different genotype. These can be haploids if you want. So there's the green, the yellow, and the red flavors. And then there's sort of a gamete storm. Each one produces a large number of gametes. And then we pull out the number of gametes from a hat blindly to produce the next generation of individuals. And anything can happen, of course. And so what's happened in this particular case is that we started out with one red gene, and now just by chance we drew two red balls in the next generation. This is just one of many, in a very large number of possible trajectories. And you just follow this over time, and you can see that what's eventually happened just by chance, eventually if we go enough generations, all the balls are of one color. There's no mutation going on. This is just sampling genes randomly from generation to generation. And when a population goes from a state like this, where one type eventually represents every type in the population, we call that fixation of the mutant allele. Now, I've drawn this so there's three flavors, but if there is a God, and that's, you know, subject for another seminar, it's a benevolent God, because generally, in any population, at any nucleotide site, there's generally no more than two flavors. So there might be green balls and yellow balls, but there's usually not three flavors at the same time. This makes our life really easy, because then we can think of a one-dimensional process, because we only need to keep track of one of the frequencies, because the other one's just one minus that frequency. So this makes life a bit easier. I'm not saying this never happens with three flavors, but it's pretty rare. Okay, so some general points to make. Whether you believe evolution is ever neutral, we still need neutral models to serve as null hypotheses. If you want to have a lot of confidence in your adaptive hypothesis for how evolution has occurred, then you ought to be able to reject the neutral model. So it's just, this can serve as a null model for trying to understand evolution. Yeah.
I mean, I'm totally naive,
but I should, yeah, let me back up just slightly. I need to explain what I mean by allele here. What I should have said is there's generally no more than two nucleotides at a single nucleotide site. If you want to think of a locus as, you know, 1,000 bases, yeah, so yeah. Sorry.
No,
yeah.
That's great. That's how I understood what you said, but I guess I find that kind of surprising given that for certain amino acids,
yeah. I'll present some data on this, and the reason for this is the mutation rate is quite low in populations. It actually declines with increasing population size, and these compensate for each other for the amount of new variation coming in populations. Where were we here? Oh, the other point that I want to make, and we'll see this when we get into selection, and I think somebody already raised this point, is that one thing we need to keep our minds around is that in evolution, everything is generally a function of the relative intensity of different forces, selection, recombination, random genetic drift. And even if there's natural selection operating on a trait, if the power of drift is sufficiently large, drift wins. It will overwhelm the directional force of selection. In that case, we say that the trait, the nucleotides operating at a particular site, are evolving in what we call an effectively neutral fashion. So the neutral model even works under many scenarios in which selection's occurring. And so this is important to keep in mind, that you can have selection operating on a population. It doesn't mean there'll be a response to selection over evolutionary time. And we'll get back to that in a more quantitative way. Exactly, yeah. I mean, if selection's strong enough, even in a tiny population, it will still be have an effect. But we'll return to this in a quantitative way. So, yeah, you're exactly right. Okay, so let's just start with a simple a mathematical calculation just to sort of get our heads around things. So here's a single mutant allele, the red mutation here, and we can ask, what's the probability it will be gone in the very first very next generation? It won't, just by chance, we won't draw it. Well, we're going to draw, these balls are now all in a hat, many representatives, and we reach in and we grab a ball. What's the probability it's not red? Well, the frequency of the red allele here is one, we're going to call this a diploid population. I hope I use an even number. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So there's 5 diploid individuals in here. N is 5. They're diploid. They each carry 2 genes. So the frequency of this in the population is 1/10 in this case. So we reach in, the probability of not drawing that allele is, the probability of drawing it is 1/2N. The probability of not drawing it is 1 minus that. Okay? And we have to draw out our 10 alleles. So the probability of not drawing it all 10 times, 10 here now being 2N, that's the probability of not drawing it at all. And this simplifies, if this is reasonably large, above 10 or so, you can use an exponential function here. The 2Ns is an approximation for this. The 2Ns cancel out. You have e to the minus 1. And so the probability of losing a mutant allele, if it's neutral in the very first generation, is about 37%. So most mutations live a very unhappy short life. They're gone in a single generation. And this, as we're going to see, is even true for selectively advantageous mutations later on. Okay, so that's our first numerical calculation. That's the probability of, losing the mutation in the first generation. What's the probability that that red allele, being neutral, what's the probability will actually go to enjoy a fate of, fixation in the population? And the population geneticists aren't allowed to answer this one. Okay, so this is a key point. If you're neutral, the probability of going on to fixation, there's no directional pressure. Your initial frequency is 1/2N. There's no directional pressure pushing you up or pushing you down. So if you're a neutral mutation, your probability of fixation is, nothing more than your initial frequency, 1/2N. And so if you were initially, so the probability of, that guy fixing is 1/10. That's its frequency. There's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 of these. The probability of fixation of the green allele would be 50%, and I guess we have 40% left. So that would be the probability of fixing any one of these 3 flavors. It's just their initial frequency. This is a very simple model here. Remember, there's only genetic drift going on. These aren't allowed to mutate into other types and so on during this process. And in fact, this process, if the population is only 10, will be over in about 20 or so generations, and we'll see why in a second. Okay, so I've already made this point. Fortunately, things are even simpler than this. There's usually no more, at a single nucleotide site, there's usually no more than 2 flavors there at a time. Okay, so just to return to this in a pictorial way, just so you understand, what we're saying is we've got these individuals, and now I've brought ourselves back to the 2 allelic types, the black balls and the white balls. That's the population. They all produce a large number of gametes. You can think of this as a big marine invertebrate or something that broadcasts spawns. And then we draw enough out to replace the population. We just repeat this over time. And the allele frequencies are fluctuating over time. This is just like the coin toss problem, right? Where you can think of the blue and the white balls as heads and tails. But you have a biased coin as the allele frequencies change over time. So that's what's going on generally. And then this, the long-term behavior of the system depends on the population size. So here we have one trajectory. Now we have a population size of 25, or there'd be 50 gene copies for a diploid. And this is just one possible trajectory of neutral evolution. All these populations are starting out at 0.5. And so this guy fluctuates, it goes up for a while. This can be very seductive if you're studying things in the wild, if you don't have an appropriate neutral model, because you might look at that and study this you know, over a period of about 20 generations and think, wow, this looks like directional selection for this allele, but whoops. And now it starts wandering back down, and then it goes up, and it eventually hits one, and that's an absorbing state. Unless we have back mutation, once that allele becomes fixed, it's fixed forever. Now we have a larger population. We multiply the population size by 10. We still have these fluctuations, but the fluctuations are scaled down by a factor of about 10. This population will eventually either hit one or zero, but it'll take, as we'll see, about tenfold longer. And then we have a population size of 2,500, and you can see we've got the fluctuations there still, but they're even tinier. And what happens with random genetic drift, everything, as we'll see, simply scales to the population size. It's essentially the same process if you rescale time to population size. In other words, it will take about 10 times more generations for this guy to go to fixation or loss as this guy, and 10 times even further for this one. And we'll see why that is in a second, I hope. And then finally, the final general point to make with just graphs is that, as I said, this is just one possible realization of the drift process as we start with an allele frequency of 0.5. So here, I don't know what the population, 100 diploids, so 200 copies of genes. Each one of these different colors is a different replicate of the drift process over time, and you can see they're all taking different trajectories. But if you let this go long enough in the simplest model, they'll all end up here, fixed for one of the alleles, or down here, fixed for the other allele. So these are called absorbing states. Okay? So that's sort of the drift process in a very sort of general pictorial terms. There's nothing magical about this. It's just a sampling of alleles from generation to generation. And there's no way to prevent this process from going on at some level. Okay? Are we reasonably okay to this point?
Let's say you see a process like this, it's measured the size of the population, and you infer an effective population size.
Yeah.
Is there another measure that gives you more information about what the underlying model could be? Like, for instance, you know, if you look at a deducive process, you get the same sort of fluctuations, but then if you look at the velocity of correlation, you can determine.
Yeah, so that's a good term to use. So that would be one prediction of drift. Right, is the changes from generation 1 to 2 should not be correlated with the changes from 2 to 3 and so on. It's a pure, I think people would call this a Markov process. There's no memory in the system. But you raise a very good point, and I hesitate to reveal it at this point early enough in the talk, but you can come up with selection scenarios that will behave in a way that you would not statistically be able to distinguish it from a drift process. So for example, if you had fluctuating selection so that randomly it's up and down in different generations, this will statistically look like a drift process. John Gillespie pointed this out quite a few years ago. So a good point, okay? So it's not, I'm trying to present this in a simple way. But there's a lot of complexities that I won't be able to go through today. But questions like this are very useful, I hope. Yeah. Yeah. It's true for any population size. If you let this go for a long enough period of time, you'll hit this or the. Well, okay. Let me back up. Remember, there's no mutation here. So if there's mutation, then, and we're going to get to this in the next step, yeah, you might hit that, but then a back mutation would send you down a little bit. And so you can maintain a polymorphism by what we would call drift mutation balance. And I'm going to get into this.
Okay, so even like in the graph above, where you have a larger population, like any 2,500,
yeah, it's just a matter of time. And if you, I'll get to this in a second, but if you rescaled this, if you measured time in units of population size divided by your time scale, generations by population size, these would all behave in the simple model in exactly the same way.
So intuitively, it would seem that if you're here 50%, then just random things would you're saying it goes to fixation. Is that because at some point it reaches sort of a tipping point and then it...
No, you could go over here and there's... Well, if you wander down to here, let's say, point two, now you're probably a fixation in the future from that position is point two versus point eight. Right? Starting at point five, it's always 50% chance you're going to hit this or this. But if you happen to wander down, conditional on where you arrive, we have to reset the probability that you're going to hit one absorbing barrier. And I'll show you, you know, it's easier to start with 0.5, but there's no reason to believe that, you know, mutant alleles are always out there at 0.5. In fact, they always start at 1 over twice for a diploid, 1 over 2n. And we'll hopefully clear that up in a second. Okay, so this is Sewell Wright. So he's one of the founders, the blessed trinity of founders, Haldane, Wright, and Fisher. I think Muller should be in there, really. Anyhow, there's Wright. He set down a lot of the foundations, specifically with respect to random genetic drift. I'll just note that early on, Fisher, one of the most brilliant mathematicians in population genetics, tried to estimate the power of random genetic drift. It turned out he was actually off by a factor of four, so that might make some of the less mathematically inclined feel a little bit better. In any event, there's a model that's frequently used, and the question is, how do we model long-term population genetic processes? And there's a model that's very frequently used in population genetics, and it's come to be known as the Wright-Fisher model, after these two guys. And the way we start out here, we start out with an idealized population. Usually we're talking about a diploid, monoecious population, so everybody produces both male and female gametes. So you have hermaphrodites. This doesn't matter a whole lot, adding in separate sexes. It matters a little, but you know, we don't worry too much about that at this point. And as I said, we could be using haploids, that would be fine. And we start out with the assumption that our population is remaining constant in size n and individuals over time. That can fluctuate as well, and I'll get back to why that's important. We use discrete generation, so this might be like a population of annual plants. It's having a population turnover every year, or some univoltine insects or something. But we can deal with overlapping generations. But for presentation purposes, I'm trying to stick with the simplest model. And as I said, we assume that individuals effectively each produce a very large number of gametes. So the sampling is the number of gametes to make the population. There's not a big an issue as sampling gametes from single individuals. And so this is, as I said, like the coin tossing problem. If we knew, for example, we have a locus with two alleles, big B and little b. There's 2n total copies, and let's say big B is represented as I copies, then we can just simply use the binomial to predict, given that we have a frequency I over 2n, what is the probability in the next generation drawing J? And so this is just the binomial expansion that I hope some of you will be quite familiar with. This is just the factorial in the binomial, and then this is the probability of drawing J, probability of drawing 2n minus J flavors, and this accounts for all the possible orders of the different draws. And so this is the overall probability in one generation of going from I copies to J. And this defines the entire process. This can then go on over and over and over again, generation after generation. So you could, for example, use a matrix approach. This would be the transition matrix. There's 2n plus 1 states the population can be in with respect to gene frequency, going from 0 over 2n to 1 over 2n to 2 over 2n, all the way up to 2n over 2n. So those are the number of states. And so this transition matrix would be a 2n plus 1 times 2n plus 1 transition matrix, with all the elements being the probability of going from one state to the other. And then this is the vector. This is a vector of probabilities of being in a particular state. And so if you just repeatedly multiply the transition matrix by the vector, this will change over time and tell you the probability that you're in different states at different future points in time. So if we have a mutant allele, this vector here would start out with all the entries would be zero, but there'd be a one in the second entry, one over 2n frequency, everything up, because that's what you are. You're starting out as one copy. And then as if you run the wheels on this for a very long period of time, numbers will start to arise in all the other elements in X, and eventually you'll get to the point where only two of the entries have numbers, and those are the probabilities you've lost. They'll be the two end elements, the first and the last element, and those are the probabilities you've been lost or gone to fixation. So that's what goes on with this. So this completely describes the process. And in the old days, it was, you know, this was thought to be fairly cumbersome because, you know, Wright worked this out back in the 30s or something, and we didn't have computers or something to do the matrix multiplication. But now this is no big deal. But threatened by this problem, this guy here, Moto Kimura, worked out some closed formulations for the probability of fixation, so you didn't have to repeatedly iterate the matrix. And these are pretty complicated mathematical functions. I don't want to go into in great detail, but this is the probability of starting at allele frequency p sub zero that you have that frequency after time t time units, and this gives a continuous distribution. He views the world here. This is a diffusion approximation, and the idea here is the population size is large enough so we can treat the allele frequencies as continuous variables instead of discrete variables, 1 over 2n, 2 over 2n, and so on. And these, you know, you get to use confluent hypergeometric distributions, which is always fun. And then you can see there's some exponential terms in here. These terms in here, there's only two things important here, the initial allele frequency, they're in here, the time and the population size, and they're all out here. So this is what governs the whole dynamics, and you can calculate the fixation probability. The probability of fixation is the probability that you eventually go to a frequency starting from this of one after time t units. And we'll return to Kimura in less elaborate mathematical details in a second. So in any event, what comes out of this work is the way to think about it is this, and we'll just show you the graphs here, and then I'm going to show you a neat example with real biology. So imagine you start out with a large number of populations starting with allele frequency 0.5. That means that the frequency distribution would just be one long spike. Everybody starts out at the same state. And then we follow this process over time, and then we count the alleles in each of the populations and make the distribution of allele frequencies over replicate populations. So they're all experiencing the same process, but in a stochastic way. Yeah, this is effectively the binomial, but this is using Kimura's diffusion approximation. But you would get essentially the same result if you had a large enough population. So you might not be able to see this. Sort of addressing Kim's point here, question here. That's saying after time n over 10 generations, this is what the dispersion would look like. So that would mean that's what, if the population size was 10, that's what the dispersion would look like in one generation, the very next generation. If the population size were 1,000, that'd be 1,000 over 10, that's what the dispersion would look like after 100 generations. So this is what I'm saying, the whole process is scaled by the population size. And then, now we're up to n over 5 generations, n over 2, n generations. So this is the point where the number of generations that's been processed is equal to the number of individuals. And shortly after that, 2n generations, you'll notice an interesting behavior here is that we started out with everybody at this allele frequency. But after about 2n generations, everybody who still has the polymorphism, there's an equal probability. The probability distribution completely becomes flat. Now you'll notice the area under these curves are becoming smaller, and that's because there's a lot piling up here and piling up here, loss and fixation. So in effect, the distribution is really a U-shaped distribution.
Simple simulations of the processes and programs like that, which just aren't parts of the I could furnish those to your students.
Great, yeah. Because the class is learning how to use MATLAB.
We're going to do all of it in MATLAB, I guess, tomorrow, Saturday.
Yeah.
But
yeah, so you could use, you could do this with writes, you know, just iterating the matrix thing, too.
Well, you can also move the branching processes and get the quantitative results after you've got the quantity.
Yeah. Yeah, there's different ways of doing it. We'll leave it at that. Okay, so that's the point. Everything scales with respect to population size. The only thing over here is now we're not starting at a frequency of 0.5, we're starting at a frequency of 0.1. And so now instead of having a, in the end, and you, but you see, you have the same process. Eventually you get to the point where the whole distribution, the probability of being in any state is about equal after a long enough period of time. So this would go to sort of a J-shaped distribution, I guess, right? Because the probability of fixation here is only 0.1, probably of loss is 0.9. So that eventually we get to the point where everybody's at 0 or 1, every population. And let's take a look at this with real data. So Sewell Wright, as I pointed out, was one of our great population geneticists. Interestingly, he had a lot of grad students, but almost none of them did population genetics. One of them was Warwick Kerr, who lives in Brazil. He's the guy who let loose the Africanized honeybees. This was his legacy. But it was an accident, I should say. But in any event, one of Wright's students, who maybe he was just burned out after doing this experiment, I don't think I ever saw anything by him again, but this is a great textbook example of random genetic drift. So Burry did two experiments, and I've summarized all the data together. There's 256 replicate populations here. So this is what we're following here are two different alleles at a locus that influences eye color. This could be anything, but this is a nice way to do it experimentally. I've only got two of the flies up here, but you can distinguish all three genotypes, the two homozygotes from the heterozygotes based on eye color. And so Burry started out with populations where he hybridized the two, he crossed the two homozygotes. So everybody's a heterozygote in the base population, meaning the allele frequency is 0.5. And he had 256 populations like this. So a lot of work. And then every day he sort of blindly, let's just say totally blindly, picked the flies. Randomly, he picked 8 females and 8 males in each of these, well, not every day, every generation turning over. He randomly took 8 males and 8 females. So the population, I said, started out at 50-50. And then every generation, he counted the allele, he figured out the allele frequencies in all 256 lines. And this is just replicating what I just showed you with real data. So after one generation, so everybody started out with 16 of each flavor, and after one generation, there's the variation. So just in one generation with a small population size, you get a lot of variation among individuals. By generation 5, a very large dispersion. There we are, our generation 10, it's completely flat distribution. Every possibility has almost equal frequency. And then you also see, though, you're starting to get a little bit of a U-shape here. Because we're fixing the alternative alleles. And as we go through time, you see the U-shape is in the sides of the U are going up further and further and further, and eventually all these populations would by chance hit one of those positions.
So there's this very famous video that is shown in Cell Biology all the time by Rogers that shows a neutrophil chasing a bacteria. Maybe lots of people have seen it. At any rate, it's kind of like a rite of passage in cell biology, but I feel this is the corresponding one for population genetics, and they're both done in the 50s. And what I'm curious about, and I've asked in the cell biology setting, and now I'm asking here, is has anybody done this sort of thing sort of in a modern way that's interesting and amusing and goes beyond the original version? I don't know if Andrew or anybody has any thoughts on that, or you, but in other words, it's so cool and so great.
Well, I think the closest analogs of modern experiments would be the kind of thing Andrew actually talked about. But we're now, my lab's doing huge replicated evolution experiments. But usually the populations are very, very large. So I'll get back to this in just a second. And they're large enough so that many mutations are actually under selection. And so you've got everything mixed together. Now, the beauty of this was the populations were small enough you could see the drift process in just a few dozen generations. And, you know, I don't know what was going through Burry's mind when he was doing this. I mean, and I should say, we know that this is neutral, because if it weren't neutral, you wouldn't be getting, I mean, there's variation here. I won't go through the statistics. You can do the statistics. But you can demonstrate that these two alternative alleles are neutral. There's no favoring of one going in one direction and one going in the other direction. So he actually demonstrated that these were behaving in a neutral fashion.
And population size is kind of weird, I mean, at least to my naive.
Well, it's going to get slightly weirder in a second, and I want it to become weirder because... Oh, okay. All right. Exactly. So, well, there's 16 individuals being chosen each generation. So you might say, well, this just has to, if these are neutral, this just has to work the way it does. And I guess it's nice, it's always nice to have data that support your theory, no matter how confident you are in your theory. But we can actually ask some more detailed questions. Rather than this qualitative approach, we can make a quantitative prediction. So for those of you not familiar, we have this thing called heterozygosity at a site. So I'm assuming most people are familiar with the Hardy-Weinberg concept. So if you have a random mating population, you have an allele frequency P, and you're a diploid, the fraction of individuals after random mating is 2P, 1 minus P. Often people use Q for 1 minus P. So that's the standing heterozygosity in a random mating population. And with drift, I won't go through the derivation, but we can make a prediction how this heterozygosity will change over time. And as you can imagine, on average, it has to go down, because once you go to fixation, the heterozygosity is 0, because P, or 1 minus P, is equal to 1, and the other one has to be 0. So we know it has to go down. And in fact, it goes down at this rate, 1 over 2n. So this 1 over 2n is going to come up frequently. This is what I tend to call the power of random genetic drift. And so this is the rate of, and you know, if n's fairly large, you can just make an exponential approximation here. You can see there's the time here. So this is saying if we start at heterozygosity times 0, and we'd be starting at 2.5 times 0.5, so that's an initial value of 0.5. Right, we can say, what would you be after T generations? And it predicts an exponential decay of the heterozygosity averaged over all 256 populations. Okay, and so there's the scaling. You can see the scaling with N right here. So here's one way to test the theory is to say, well, is the heterozygosity actually going down at the rate predicted? So the rate predicted would be, remember there's 8 males and 8 females, so n would be 16. So the decay rate would be 1 over 32 if it was a perfect fly world here. And so this is the rate that would be predicted here with n equal, you know, half males and half females. Oh, okay, let me back up a second then. At 16, the heterozygosity would be, 16 means that half, there's 32 copies of the allele, so a 16 means an allele frequency of 0.5. So at that position, the heterozygosity would be 2 times 0.5 times 1 minus 0.5. Let me pick, what's a quarter? 8. So 8. That would be an allele frequency of 0.25, 8 over 32. And so you'd have a 0.25 in there and a 0.75 in here. So every one of these classes has a different level of heterozygosity. But as you go out from here, that the highest heterozygosity you can have in this case is 0.5. And as you go towards the boundaries, it goes to 0, and it's symmetric. Does that help? Yeah, and we're asking, what is the average heterozygosity over all these populations? And it's going to 0 because almost everybody's eventually over here at allele frequency 1, or allele frequency 0, or allele frequency 1. Okay?
Is this just very aggregate to establish this is a Mendelian single gene trait?
Well, you could say that, yeah. Although they knew that, and that's why, I mean, there'd been a lot of work done in these eye color mutants before, so. If it was a multi-locus trait, and you know, anything might have happened, but they knew this was segregating as a single Mendelian trait in advance. And I'll just say there's no change, significant change in the mean frequency. So the average frequency of the allele over all these remains 0.5 throughout the experiment. It's not 0.5 in any one population, but half are going up and half are going down, so the long-term average is the same. Okay, so now this point about population size, this is what the prediction is, but here's the data. So the heterozygosity is being lost faster than predicted. But if you say the population size is 9, if you plug a 9 in here rather than a 16, it fits the data very well. So what this is saying is that this population fits the theory really well if we're willing to say that the population is effectively equal to 9 rather than 16. So this is related to what we call the effective population size. Now there's many reasons why this population could be behaving as a 9, of course, rather than a 16.
So then I guess the answer to my question would be no, because this you would not have guessed just from knowing the person who gave you. So 9 versus 16 has to do with fly behavior and less to do with the way you put the experiment together. So this is something new.
Well, genetically, though, the trait is behaving as a Mendelian single segregating factor.
But this 9 versus 16 is an independent measurement that you need somehow.
It's a measure of the population size. It doesn't alter the fact that it's still a single Mendelian trait. Okay, so let me return to that in a second. After I get into the concept of effective size, so it is a good question. And the Wright-Fisher model in its simplest form, N is actually the number of adults, and they're all assumed to be created equal. Now they do actually, there is actually variance in reproductive success among the individuals, but it's just assumed to be random Poisson, because you're randomly drawing balls out of the hat. Just by chance, somebody might not get any kids in one generation, but that's a random process. So what's going on here is that so I guess in some sense I'm about to answer your question. These are not ideal, this is not an idealized population. All individuals are not created equal. Probably what's going on is, you know, Bury damaged a fly or something, or just by chance, you know, some flies don't, you know, they might not have gotten as much food as others in the vial and so on. So there's variance in reproductive success among the different individuals, simple as that. There's the variance in family size is bigger than randomly drawing gametes out of a hat. And this is a fact of life. This is where biology comes in. And it turns out that almost everything you can think of that biologically at a demographic level deviates from the ideal Wright-Fisher model, almost always it will cause the population to behave effectively as though it's smaller than the total number of individuals. So this is maybe the most important message here. The number of individuals that an ecologist would tell us is in a population is important for ecology, but it's not the number we worry about in genetics.
How does the gender of the flies play? I thought, well, 9 is around 8, so maybe it's just, well, there are about 8 females and 8 males, and that's what it's coming from. Would you have gotten the same behavior if all the flies could mate with each other instead of
You would get, let me return to that. This is going to be one of the points I'm making. But he did enforce a 1-to-1 sex ratio, right? And that would deviate itself in a normal vial. There's just not going to always be exactly the number of sons and daughters, so you're right. Variation in gamete production due to selection. These flies, there's no selection on eye color, but they probably also have variance in other aspects of their genetic background. So some flies may just be better endowed than others. So it could just be variance from that standpoint. Or if they even vials have, you know, spatial variation. So, you know, depending on where you are as an egg, you may grow up with more goodies than somebody else. So that would cause increased variance in family size. Any kind of population subdivision, anything like this causes the effective size to go down because it means the well-endowed individuals are contributing more to the next generation than the guys who didn't get as many resources. The same thing would be true of population subdivision. If you had certain individuals in one subpopulation versus others, if there's variation in ecology there and resource availability, that would do it. Uneven sex ratio. It turns out that if you have uneven sex ratios, in some sense, the rarer sex is a genetic bottleneck for the population because everybody has exactly one dad and one mom. So you can imagine if only one male got all the females, that's like a whole bottleneck each generation through the male side of the genome. That means half the genes coming from the next generation came from just one individual. So variation sex ratio can be very important. And again, everything's pushing the effective size below the absolute. So it's all this stuff is operating in the same direction, leading the prediction that effective population sizes are smaller than actual. Temporal variation in population size, I think Andrew alluded to this. I'm not going to go into great details here, but turns out that population bottlenecks have much more strong influence than a population flush because of the reciprocal nature with respect to population size. And you can calculate a long-term effective size. That turns out to be the harmonic mean of the per generation sizes. And that's going to be much closer to the smallest population you ever experienced than the largest. Okay, for big things like mammals, Dick Frankham years ago, with direct estimates of N, anyway, I won't go into, found that the effective size is typically in big vertebrates about 10% of the actual size. It's going to be much worse for the kinds of, for small unicellular organisms and things, orders of magnitude worse.
Where gamete production is perfect, where you get 2 alpha and 2A from every mating, and every A and A each other.
Maybe.
Yeah, I guess I wanted to complement that by saying, so should I be thinking in this case of like the bull walrus?
Let me keep moving on, because I'll show you, this is the least of the problem with NE being smaller than N. Demography almost always does it, but there's another critical issue that has much more influence than demography. Everything's going to keep pointing, though, in this direction, that populations effectively behave as though they're much smaller than their absolute size. You had a question. Yes. Okay. So this relates back to the question here. The idea here is that this is why we call it the effective population size. The idea is if you knew the effective size of a population, that's defining the way a Wright Fisher ideal population would work. So instead of having N in there, you would put NE in there. That's the idea. There's a lot of subtle things I'm glossing over here because there's different ways to define effective sizes and so on, but you're absolutely right. Does that help? That's what we're trying to, how we're trying to tie the biology back to these relatively simple models. Okay. So if N's important, you might think, okay, we just scale N by, you know, 10% or something, and then ecologists could tell us, you know, with our correction factor, you know, data from ecology would tell us what the effective size is. This is an intriguing plot here, a scaling law from ecology. It's been around for a long time. This is the number, all kinds of organisms, anywhere from mammals to microbes. Slope is -1 if you just draw that particular slope. What is there? There's 20 logs here. And 25 logs here. This is an inverse relationship, and this is saying that if you double the size of an organism, reduce the number of individuals per meter squared by 50%. So if you're really naive, you would just say that you, well, you wouldn't have to be naive, I guess, but one way of looking at this, if you thought that NE was just scaled to this, then a doubling of the size of an organism would reduce the effective size by 50%. And what this clearly shows us, the main point I want to make is big things are represented by smaller total numbers in the wild than small things, okay? So the issue, though, that we're going to encounter now is NE does not even remotely scale with the size of the organism. And in fact, I'll be making the argument, maybe down here numbers matter, but once you get into really small things, the effective size levels off dramatically. And that's because it's not just the numbers of individuals that matter. What becomes really important is the unfortunate, depending on your view, situation that all our genes are tied together on individual chromosomes. And that means that the fate of individual nucleotide sites is not independently determined, but determined as well by everybody that you're physically linked to. So let me start with and this is where selection comes in, because selection can actually influence the effective population size. Let's start with a very simplest case. Imagine you have a truly asexual population. So nobody is sharing genes. There may be very few organisms that literally behave like this. We like to talk about bacteria being truly asexual, but that's we know they share genes by various mechanisms. But let's just start with it just to make the point. No sex whatsoever. You have a clonal population. Everybody in the population is picking up new deleterious mutation. Most mutations are deleterious. So everybody's randomly picking up deleterious mutations, and those are being selected out of the population. And what you will end up with is a selection mutation balance. You will end up with a distribution of individuals, and this would just be the count of, being very simple here, everything's the same flavor. This would be the count of the number of deleterious mutations in different classes of individuals. And so this population has a certain mutation rate and power of selection, so I guess the average individual has 9 deleterious mutations, which is not at all unrealistic. But this ends up taking on a distribution that's roughly Poisson. And because it's roughly Poisson, the number of individuals in the zero class, these are the best individuals, right? These are the most fit individuals. And under the Poisson, the frequency in the zero class, those of you who remember the Poisson, is just e to the minus the mean. So if the mean is 10, the fraction of these guys in the population would be e to the minus 10. And so the point here is that very few individuals reside in the best class. But if this population is not going to suffer the fate, what we call Muller's ration, and eventually go down the tubes, then if you think way out into the future, everybody, all descendants, must come from that best class. We're not allowing back mutation at this point, just trying to make a point. And so that means effectively, you know, this population might be enormous, but the genetic effective size is not the number of individuals in all the classes. These guys, everybody beyond the zero class is what I would call the living dead. They're around for a while. These guys over here could leave quite a few descendants for a while, but ultimately, in the long run, everybody has to come from that best class. Okay, so that's one way of thinking with chromosomal architecture going on, because everybody's tied together. Your fate as a clone is dictated by all the other mutations in your entire genome. Now, we might not believe that that's the critical, this is sort of an extreme situation. Yeah?
Do we know what kind of time scales we're dealing with for these mutations
to be wiped from the population? Yeah, so roughly the time scale, suppose a mutation has a disadvantage of, we use S, selective disadvantage of 0.01. You can think about that in a simplistic way as that's the rate at which it's being purged from the population per generation. And so roughly speaking, the persistence time would be 1 over that. So in this case, it'd be about 100 generations, and that mutation would be a limit on average from the population. So that's one way of thinking about the time scale. What's that? I'm assuming that all, just to, for simplistic reasons, just to, for you know, reasons of presentation, I'm assuming that all mutations here are deleterious. This is a, otherwise it's a perfectly adapted population. It's found all the good solutions, and then there's recurrent deleterious mutations.
Okay, so in some sense, I guess what I'm trying to understand is whether this is a startling conclusion, but sort of based on very unrealistic assumptions. So it's
Oh, yeah, this is based on lots of unrealistic assumptions. I'm just trying to make the point, though, that, you know, individuals heavily loaded with mutations are unlikely to contribute to the future of the population, unless one of these got hit with a super beneficial mutation, and so the net effect would be to push you back down there.
Yeah, no,
well, let me, when I move on to the next slide, I will relax some of the unrealistic assumptions.
I guess I was just going to say exactly what you just said, which is that as long as there are relatively large effects, beneficial mutations available, guys quite a way back from the front can contribute, and people like Michael Desai actually have experimental evidence that, you know, growing yeast on a supposedly rich medium where it's been grown for a long time, exactly those sort of mutations do occur. And so that some of the assumption. So I guess a lot of it comes back to the question of how much in natural populations, because of sort of arms races and red queen thing, are there constantly beneficial mutations available? And if that's true, then you do get to question whether this is the right way to look at it.
Yeah, I don't want to defend this as the perfect way to look at things. I'm just trying to make some points now that you'll appreciate, and I think hopefully it helps to look at the extreme examples just to get an appreciation of what's going on. But let's take a look at this a little bit more. Now we have an organism that's recombining. Okay, it does have recombination. And this is just some small region of a chromosome. And this process still has implications for a small region of a chromosome in a recombining species, because recombination rates are, you know, on the order of something like 10 to the minus 8 per adjacent base pair. So spans of chromosomes that are on the order of hundreds of thousands of bases will often never experience recombination in their history and the genealogy of the population. But in any event, most mutations, I think we all agree on, are deleterious, the vast majority of mutations. And so this is a problem. Suppose that you have a population. This is just a sample of chromosomes from some population, and these little tick marks are just polymorphisms. So, you know, two guys have some nucleotide there and the rest don't, and so on. It's just a measure of the variation in the population, the background variation. But every one of these green dots is, some of these chromosomes have a green dot on them, and those are deleterious mutations. And so those, let's say, have a large enough selective disadvantage, so they will be removed. So 0.01 is a pretty whopping big selective disadvantage, but they would then be removed, each one of these chromosomes, in about 100 generations from the population, which of course is a flash, an evolutionary timescale. And what that means is that none of these chromosomal segments with deleterious mutations will contribute to the future of the population. Okay, so the idea, you can extend the concept to think about relaxing the assumption about recombination. So this population is, I don't know, it's got around 10 or so chromosomes, but effectively it's behaving as though it's only got 4. But let's also look at this issue, because we've totally forgotten about beneficial mutations, and they certainly do occur. This can actually have even more dramatic effects on the effective population size, depending on how frequent they are, depending on their advantages. So imagine, again, we're back to a sample of chromosomes, and these are all the background variants going on. That chromosome has picked up a beneficial mutation, strong enough to be perceived by natural selection. And so selection is promoting this particular chromosomal segment over time, and eventually everybody in the population has that chromosomal segment, and all these other guys have been left behind. Because this guy it's a zero-sum game. So you can't promote this guy without demoting everybody else. And so you can see we've washed out all the background variation. It's all been eliminated. So this is what we call a selective sweep. And think about what this might do. So for example, that tick mark there, that might have been a beneficial mutation itself. But this guy came along and it was even more beneficial than that one. And so if its benefit is sufficiently greater than that one, it will outcompete that beneficial mutation. It will be lost from the population. That tick mark next to the blue ball might have actually been a deleterious mutation. But because it's adjacent to this one, there's in the time this guy takes to go to fixation, there's no recombination between those two nucleotides, and it's dragged to fixation along with the beneficial mutation. So let me finish the example and see if I can make the final point clear. A bunch of hands just went up. So the point that I want to make is that any kind of selection reduces, and non-recombining backgrounds reduces the efficiency of natural selection. So if there were high rates of recombination going on in this region, the fate of this population would be, eventually it would be this. That guy would go to fixation on one segment, that guy would be lost, and that guy would go to fixation. So recombination in this sense increases the efficiency of selection. So any questions remaining? Or? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But this is like kind of the only reason it looks that way is because you would only be looking at that one locus by itself in isolation.
Right. So this is an important point. So again, you can see that all these genetic effects are also driving the effective size below the absolute size. But the more disturbing thing is that the effective population size in the same organism can vary among chromosomal segments. Depending on these historical effects. Okay, does that follow? I mean, if you happen to have some region that was experiencing lots of sweeps, its local the effective size for that segment of the chromosome would be small. But of course, everybody's tied together, so things are sort of averaged out. And you know, I'm just trying to make a general point. Okay, hold on to that, Boris. Next slide. Yeah, you're absolutely right. I'm going to cover this. Okay, I think let me see what the next slide or two is, and then we'll maybe take a break immediately, or depending on if I'm at a breaking point. But what Boris just raised is something I'm going to address. All this stuff is going on at the same time, right? And so we would like one way to summarize, actually empirically, what the effective size of a population is. Okay, I'm going to give one more slide and then we'll take the break. And I don't know if we'll get through all this today, but we'll maybe come close. This is an empirical way of looking into the problems I just raised. So the point was that low rates of recombination reduce the efficiency of, let me reword this. Okay, what I've been trying to argue is that high rates of recombination will effectively increase the regional effective population size, because it frees you up from all the stochastic effects of everybody you've been linked to. One reflection of high effective population sizes is large amounts of variation in the region, because mutations bringing in variation everywhere along the chromosome, but drift is taking it out everywhere along the chromosome. If you have a high regional effective population size, drift will be eliminating the variation less frequently, and this will be reflected in a higher standing level of variation. So one prediction of all of this stuff put together is that regions of high recombination rates will exhibit higher standing levels of variation. That higher standing level of variation is reflecting long-term effective population size in that region. And so this is just a measure of nucleotide heterozygosity. I'm going to return to this with some real other real data, but this was either from mouse or human. It's been done both ways, but the point here is that there is variation in the local recombination rate along chromosomes, and what you can see from these data is regions of chromosomes that have little recombination per physical distance have lower levels of variation than regions with high levels of recombination. This has often been taken to be support for this idea of those deleterious things, weeding things out, that's called background selection, and the beneficial thing is often called adaptive selective sweeps. They all do the same thing. And so this is often taken to be a reflection of those underlying population genetic processes. The main thing is that even within an individual, you can see that the standing level of variation depends on where you are in the chromosome, depending on your recombination rate. One caveat here, this kind of analysis assumes that recombination is not mutagenic, and that's not necessarily true and introduces, you know, another twist. But I think this is a good break point, so I think we should stop now, and then we start again at 15 minutes of. Was that the plan? Okay.